from MLU headquarters in Philadelphia.
You should go underneath it.
Oh, way out deep!
This is Cleats and Cuffies.
Hit it! Oh, what a one! Murray!
Everything ultimate, from the field to the boardroom.
Hey, you got this?
There?
Oh, yes!
Hello,
Mr. Graham!
And welcome to Cleats and Cufflinks. We're back again, episode 41, I think.
How do you remember all those numbers?
You know, each week I have to make a small graphic for the podcast that I upload.
And
that more or less reminds me where I am. We'll have a big, we'll do a little little celebration on our 50th. You know, you got to do a little thing there. I think the halfway to 100 kind of
That's
celebration.
That's where we get the first L, right?
Yeah.
We're not using Roman numerals. We're using...
We're using
the Arabic.
Good old-fashioned Arabics. Good old-fashioned American numbers. Right. That's what we're using.
As soon as we got to use them, we took them over.
Yeah, now they're ours.
That's how this all works.
Exactly. All right, well, you know, we're a little earlier in the week recording today. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the episode's still going to come out on Thursday, but it's Tuesday today, so a little earlier in the week. So if anything happens on Wednesday that we don't talk about, that's why. But thanks for making it up. You've been playing some of the frisbee yourself the last weekend, right?
Yeah, I'm running out of time to play frisbee myself, as it turns out, because once the MLU season starts, I basically don't do that anymore.
Rapidly approaching, about a week and a half away. It's insane.
Once we get to Summer League, because Summer League games are during the week, then a little bit here and there.
Yeah,
I've been playing indoor, played Winter League indoor, played Winter League outdoor. Then I've been playing in the Ultimate Indoor Championships, which are kind of a loosely organized thing that culminates. And so they have like sectionals and regionals and then nationals or easterns or something. But anyway, the idea is you're playing 5-on-5, three men, two women. You can also go three women, but the other team doesn't have to also match that. But the thing that I like about indoor is that it's not really like regular Ultimate.
No, it's not.
And specifically, for someone who likes to chase down blocks.
One of my favorite things.
Yeah. Beat someone on an undercut.
Love that.
Yeah. Those need to be about how long for most of those? Like a 20-yard?
I like to have a lot of time.
A good distance to
catch up to somebody. A lot of time, yeah.
The thing that I love so much about indoor Ultimate is that there isn't any space.
Yeah.
There's no space to get up to full speed. There's no way for you to get so far out of the play that you can't recover if it's a bad throw. So if somebody floats a disc, there are generally the entire team can get there because it's not that far to run. And I've had a lot of fun playing indoor generally because it's small-sided. It's a little bit different. The way that you look or the way that you can look and process the field is a little bit better, both on offense and defense. Fewer players to keep track of.
Yep.
But the most important thing for me playing indoor, the thing that I find most engaging, is playing defense, and that's. As someone who never really liked playing defense, it's nice to be in a situation where I'm enjoying it again.
Right.
But the reason that I enjoy it is because it's really difficult to play defense in indoor. Because even someone like you would be able to complete a long backhand.
Wow. That was a pretty direct burn.
But the thing is that like as soon as you step indoors, you get rid of the wind, you get rid of the elements, and everybody's a thrower.
Yeah, it takes all the variables out. It takes all the variables out of throwing. It's kind of interesting because I think from an offensive perspective, you know, indoor when I played was the first time that I got to handle.
Right.
And I did because I was a pretty experienced club player at that point. And while I wasn't a great thrower, I knew the decision-making processes really well.
And that's one of the key.
And I was trusted to handle because.
Because
even I can throw a back.
That is not even that. Because oftentimes, if you were handling, that would mean that we had just gotten a block. So you didn't want to go back and have to get another block. You'd rather get a goal and then try to get another block.
That is always the best. That's the best thing. We got. And it's interesting, too, because I played a lot of soccer growing up. And while indoor ultimate kind of allows offensive players to do things they couldn't necessarily do outdoors because of the bigger field and the wind, indoor soccer is actually kind of the opposite, where it will expose poor touch and poor offensive control in a second. And I think when I played my first season of indoor ultimate, I was surprised that it was so different from outdoor, but at the same time, not different in the way that I necessarily expected.
Did you play with a wall around the field, or did you have like?
No, we played with a wall, which was terrible.
So you could like shoot it off of the wall, bounce it to yourself off of the wall, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Oh, with the side. Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. We played that in like the old hockey rink.
Yeah, that's what we used to do.
Just some
indoor soccer.
Carpet.
Our team was one of the. We got kicked out because we kept running people into the boards. And we eventually flipped one of the boards accidentally.
Okay.
And they were like, you can't be doing that. I loved indoor soccer because the only skill that I had as a soccer player was shooting. And in indoor, if you miss the goal, it just hits the board and comes back to you, so you get to shoot again.
And you're almost always within shooting distance, so it's pretty good, yeah.
But so the thing that you mentioned with touch and with the ability to sort of control in soccer, it's actually really relevant for indoor too, because we played one of the teams we played against. I was confident that we were going to beat them because we could just let their deep cuts be open and they would just throw it way out the back of the end zone.
They just couldn't handle the compressed field.
Right, because they're looking at that cut and they're like, oh, I really have to put it out in front of him so that he's going to be able to chase this down. Yeah, no, there's nowhere to chase.
There's no chasing.
You have to just hit him with the frisbee. Yeah. And that's sort of the thing that makes defense so challenging. The challenge in indoor playing defense is you can't lose sight of the thrower. It's like playing basketball. You can't lose sight of the ball. You always have to know where your man is, where the ball is, and where you are. Sometimes it's difficult to know where
you have to triangulate.
Yes. As all the coaches always tell you.
Yes, yes.
But lots of ultimate players rely on the notion of the disc goes up, they hear an up call, or the field changes and they can tell the disc is up, and then they're going to go find it. With that second step inserted, you don't actually have enough time to catch up to the disc in indoor. Because if somebody says up to you and you turn and look for the frisbee, chances are it's already been caught. So the best thing that you can look for in indoor as a thrower is any defender who turns his back to you or turns her back to you, their player's open right now wherever you want them to be. Because you can honestly throw to the other side of the defender and the offensive player can get there first because there isn't enough time. So that challenge, it makes you work on footwork, it makes you work on balance, it makes you work on seeing the frisbee and anticipating a little bit more rather than trusting that you'll have the chance to make it up through superior athleticism, which I never really had that much of.
So. Do you think this translates to outdoor? You know, is it good for players, if we're talking about player development, which we talked about a lot on here, is it good for players to get out there and play some indoor ultimate? Is this like a recommendation? Is this a dusty recommendation? It's not going to spoil them with the throwing portion?
The thing that I would say is the best way to develop as a player is to play. It doesn't matter if you're playing 2-on-2 or 3-on-3 or just doing marking. Like any situation where you have to make decisions based on what your team is doing, reading the field, whether there's 5 people, 7 people, 4 people, it just doesn't matter. Get out and play. You can play with 20 people, 30 people. It's like just the skills and the repetitions, the reading the field again. And defensively, the challenge of sticking with your defender, sticking with your offensive player for every single step while still keeping your head back to the frisbee, that's something that not all frisbee players learn how to do. So indoor is a good chance to work on it. And you tend to get lots of reps in indoor because it's small-sided.
Yeah.
So with 5 people, you're more likely to touch the frisbee more often.
You're going to get a lot of chance to be involved. Yeah. That's interesting. All right. So get out there, play some indoor ultimate.
It's a blast. I like it.
Get involved. It's a little late now. We're moving into outdoor season, I guess. But if you have a chance, according to Dusty, play indoor ultimate.
Thumb and pen up.
And according to me, beware of the walls.
All right. They're not moving.
So today we had I got a package in the mail, actually, just this morning.
Yeah.
Which is pretty exciting. A package from Poland. And those of you watching this podcast as opposed to listening to it can see the contents of that package on our mannequin behind us. So we got a package from Ultimatum Gdansk, which I know has a G sound in the beginning. It's Gdansk, which is a city up in the north of Poland.
Yeah, right on the sea there.
Right on the sea. The jersey you'll see behind us has a giant picture of Neptune on it, looking particularly upset.
Well, you know, you have to be a little intimidating. You can't just be a benevolent god if you're going to be a sports team, right?
Yeah, no, there has to be. Yeah, exactly. There has to be, you know, it's a very, I would say, an irritated sea god.
Well, let's just say this before we get into how irritated that sea god is.
Yeah.
I really like this jersey.
It's a fun jersey. I mean, it's...
I wasn't sure what it was going to look like until it showed up, because, you know, we had some idea that they might be sending us a jersey. Yep. It might be one color or the other. And I like this a lot. I would wear that on a regular basis, not necessarily just for Ultimate.
It's an intimidating jersey. I'm going to say that if you're blessed with a belly of some variety, it's really going to... It's really going to prominently display the sea god. Anyway, the guy who sent us this, and I'm going to butcher his name because it has a lot of Y's and Z's in it, but is Piotrek Shibila. I believe I'm saying
it's
that right.
Close.
And Piotrek, I'm sorry if I messed that up
too
terribly.
We've worked on it a lot, and we decided that you were doing a little better than I was, so you were just...
I got to say it. Yeah. I was the one who got to say it.
I think
it.
You did great.
We did some Google pronunciation. He sent us a pronunciation, but that's what we have. So Piotrek sent us this. Piotrek is an interesting dude in general. One, huge Ultimate fan, big fan of the MLU, fan of cleats and cufflinks, which, you know, he's one of six.
Well, I met another one just this past weekend at Ultimate Indoor Championships.
Really?
A guy turned to me and said, I think I know you. Are you Dusty? I was like, yes. Where do you know me from? Have I insulted you at some point in some way without even realizing?
What did I do to you?
It's like, no, I've actually been listening to the cleats and cufflinks. It's like, oh, that's great. It was fantastic. Meeting people out, talking about Frisbee.
Growing an audience.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing right here. That's what they call this.
That's the cufflinks term for it.
We're building an audience.
The cleats term for it is hanging out with Frisbee players.
Yeah, that's another way to look at it, yeah. But Piotrek, he's such a big fan that he convinced his now wife, when they were getting married, to honeymoon in Philadelphia so that they could come to the championship game last year.
And what a championship game it was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they got to see some action. I told my wife this story.
Yeah.
And she was not pleased.
But she didn't state that suggestion would have been grounds for divorce? It was a little softer than that?
It was softer than that because she knew this was, you know, the marital bliss that lasts, I think, like 6 weeks after you get married. They were still in that window. Yeah. So, so they came to the game. He actually sent some pictures of him at the game, which I may tweet a couple of those out later. Took like a paparazzi shot of a bunch of MLU people, which I liked. But so he was involved in getting Ultimate started in Dansk in a couple different ways. So first of all, they had a team that he tells us was started in 2004 and carried on through 2013. But in his words, they stopped developing kind of sport-wise and organizationally. Like, it just kind of stagnated a little bit is what it felt like. And the Pro Ultimate thing kind of started up around that, and he became a fan of it. I listened to a lot of the early cleat stuff that I did with Jeff, which was a little more cufflinksy than what we've done so far. A little more of the business side of it.
We're still finding our feet.
We're finding our feet. We're gonna, you know, we're gonna even these things out.
Heavy Ultimate.
There's a lot of gravity pulling me toward Ultimate over here. You're a dense object.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment today, I suppose.
It's like a dying sun, just pulling everything in toward Ultimate.
I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, there you go. You know, but he said that watching that, listening to cleats, he got inspired and worked with some people to build a new team. And a lot of what they tried and what they wanted to be was a real sports team, right? Very different from the way they'd started the first time, which from what I read between the lines of what he sent us, you know, he sent us a nice couple paragraphs, was more of a social thing. Whereas
Which still is.
But this team was intended to be more of a sports team. So they did things like they hired a pro athletic coach who on Wednesday comes in, teaches them like agility training, endurance, speed, all that type of stuff, running form. They worked on partnerships both with on the sleeve of the jersey is something from, I think it's called Moser Dansk, which is the city sports council. So they work with the city sports council in the city. They partnered with Stadion Energia Dansk, which was in the Euro 2012, soccer tournament. I'm sure you're a fan of that competition.
I'm at least aware of it.
Yeah. Was one of the stadiums used there. And so they've been playing on some of their facilities. Not the main field yet.
Well, To be fair, most American audiences do not understand exactly how pristine European soccer pitches are. It's the sort of thing where you might once in your life get to walk on one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just not used for everyday play. Like, we kind of overuse lots of things here. Leaving that, like, yeah, they may not be playing on the main field, but nobody's playing on the main field.
He says they're trying to play on the main field, but he calls them the Green Master, which I assume, you know, the groundskeeper,
yeah.
Very skeptical of the idea.
Well, so, there's a Frisbee. How could you? That's the we always get skepticism when we show them the toy that we play with.
It's
even
true.
Though it's the only one that we keep catching and throwing that has a handle on it that you're supposed to catch and throw by.
And even though in the Reader's Digest most recently I was reminded that more Frisbees are sold in the United States than baseballs, basketballs, and footballs combined.
Reader's Digest?
Reader's Digest. A little fun fact.
Combined?
And that does still exist. Combined.
Wait. I have so many questions.
Well, I mean, you got to assume they're accounting for every Frisbee sold. So if you've gotten a promotional disc from an insurance company, that probably counts. Yeah.
Those little mini discs that you use for markers in disc golf?
Possibly. I don't know what size they go up and down to.
But they all fly, yeah. Is kind of the point. Mm. And then we can use them for various feats of skill and strength and humor. Sometimes,
and humor, and as you said, if you can play,
right? Like, why not? That's the whole. That's why we do.
That's the whole reason
stuff.
It's there. But anyway, the thing I like kind of most about these guys and the message that Piotrek was trying to send to us is that one of the big takeaways they had from the professional ultimate thing that's going on here, even though you know, oh, I should also say their team. Inaugural season finished 12th at Nationals in Poland. Congratulations to them. That's a great debut. So I'm going to throw that out. Congratulations. Nice work, guys. But the takeaway that they had from, you know, listening to, you know, us talk, reading what we're writing, watching the pro leagues develop, is this idea of accessibility of the game for players. Mm. And so it's a big thing that he talked about was trying to make the sport affordable for the players in the club. And obviously this is difficult. They're not a revenue generating organization, I don't suspect.
At least not yet.
But they're trying to work on sort of having some club money that they can use to offset the cost for players to go to tournaments, to travel, to do that type of thing, because it's expensive. So the way that they've organized their team is around these kind of peers of, you know, professional level training and kind of affordability, accessibility. And they have also, they have somebody who's a pro doing their Instagram and their Facebook,
yeah.
Which you can actually see. It's pretty good if you go check it out. So they've done this stuff that's trying to professionalize both their image, their player experience, and their player development, which I think is really interesting.
Well, and this is one of those things that we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I can't remember which specific number it was on. You're the numbers guy, not me, apparently, in this context. Is that we talked about what are the assumptions that you make before you start dealing with something, dealing with a problem, trying to solve that, or even just walking into a discussion. What are the assumptions that you're making? And the assumptions that we've made for so long about Ultimate are it's not a real sport. It's something that you do in your like part-time. It's something that you... don't commit everything to. And if you create organizations with that as an underlying notion, then yes, you're going to have problems maintaining yourself over time and growing your players and all of this. But if you look at it from an assumption of, we're going to take this seriously, we're going to look at this as though we are athletes, as though this is a real sport, and you start from that assumption, the way that you try to work through these problems is totally different. It's not just something that we're messing around with a little bit. Although, to be fair, Frisbee's still fun. It's really fun to play.
It is,
right?
Fun.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
So it's,
and that's okay,
right? And you don't have to get far away from that in order to just the word you use is professionalize. You don't have to professionalize your experience as a player and as an organization. You just need to back up and reconsider what your assumptions are.
And I think it's interesting to point out too that there are club organizations in the States that have obviously preceded the kind of pro thing in doing this. You know, Sockeye over the years in Seattle has done a great job, like having that longevity, you know, being around for a long time. Furious up in Vancouver has had been around a long time and been and been using trainers and using kind of professional approaches to the game and having that kind of level of commitment, right? And it's that groundwork that these top club teams have done for a long time that, you know, really made us look and say, well, this could go to the next thing, which is this professional thing. It's not that this sprung out of nowhere, is my point.
Right, right. It took all of those people looking at the same problem with the same set of assumptions to realize that some of the assumptions were off a little bit.
Yeah.
And one of the things you mentioned was that they have somebody actually doing their Instagram account.
Yeah.
If someone who's not on the team doing that. That's one of the things that was most eye-opening when I first started working with the MLU. I was like, oh, all those silly little jobs that we were trying to find people to do for our club teams, that's actually taken care of by the league.
Yeah.
That's awesome. You know, like, you mean I don't have to tweet about myself all the time? You mean in order for us to get publicity, somebody else is going to do that for me? That's fantastic. Like, I don't have to update the website all the time? Great. I can just play? That's great.
Yeah, I think that we hear that a lot. You know, I think people enjoy the club experience. People enjoy the pro experience. People enjoy their college experience. One of the things we do hear a lot is it's nice not to have to worry about a lot of these other things. And I think that's part of it too. Like they say they want to make, you know, the team affordable and accessible for players, but that affordability is not just money. It's also time, right? And, you know, somebody's got, if you're on a team and you are a traveling club team, someone's got to book hotel rooms. Someone's got to figure out what flight people need to take. Someone's got to know when the captain's meeting is. Someone's got to figure out, you know, fields for you to practice on, you know, all the things that need to get figured out. Somebody has to do them.
Right.
And no matter what your organization is, somebody has to do them. And the approach that the professional leagues have taken is that, you know, it's not going to be the players that have to do them. The approach that their team seems to have taken is let's try to remove some of that burden from the players. And I wonder how many other club teams sort of have that and are taking that off. I mean, coaches are becoming more and more
a thing. That's a first step.
Which is huge.
I mean, for the team that I'm involved with right now, John Doe, I'm the coach, obviously. I'm not playing. I'm not worth the time as a club player anymore. Too many games, et cetera. And but we have basically an individual player who takes care of most of the bookings and the money and all of that. And we had that same thing with Pike back when. We had the same thing.
Who was that?
It was Brian Lowe.
Was it?
Yes, it is absolutely Brian
I feel
Lowe.
Sad that I didn't know that. Thank you, Brian. You're the best.
I mean, he may have done a good job
I guess
of
you're right,
pushing
yeah.
that out to
I
some know. Other people on yeah. bits and pieces. But each club takes care of that in their own way. But the thing is, it is generally a player.
Yeah.
In order to convince somebody who's not a player to take care of all of that, like
you
need to
them.
Invest. You need to invest something in them. You need to give something back to them.
Yeah.
And trying to build a long-term organization where you don't just have one player who does this, but you have an organization that takes care of it. So that doesn't mean that one person does it every year for the next 7 years. It means that we set up a system where we get this done either by an external person or by sharing the burden internally from a team.
And it'd be interesting to see what club teams have done. I mean, if anyone has some information on what their team has done, we'd love to hear it. I mean, I think there's clearly teams that are good at this now, that have good procedure in place. Like, and how replaceable the people parts are of that would be interesting to know, because that's always a thing with any organization, right? You know, we have a big organization here. If we lose somebody for any reason, how easy is it to put someone back in place? And that's something we worry about a lot because we're a business and we have to,
right?
But when you're a club, you know, you have somebody who knows all the passwords and procedures for getting things done. You know, if they step down or they can no longer do that, like, are you lost at sea? And I think a lot of clubs have probably figured this out, but I'm curious as to how that's happened, you know, because it seems on the club level of the clubs that I'm familiar with to be a very organic development. Whereas I look at this and it seems very intentional.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think the intentionality of it is something that more people and teams can use going forward as they start trying to either make more teams or reform the teams that they have. Because building an organization is difficult and maintaining an organization is almost just as difficult until you get that serious momentum, that history, that sort of rolling down a hill kind of feeling. But to look at it not just as, oh, this is a club Frisbee team, that's great, to look at it specifically as an organization that exists not just this season, but before that and after.
Yep, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think this is great. And I want to say thank you again to Piotrek and to Ultimatum Dansk. We're excited to have the jersey as part of our collection. Excited to hear more about how your team's doing and growing. And also, you know, if you want to send us a jersey, we'll take it. We'll put that back there. We'll talk about it. But even apart from that, if you want to send us your stories, we'd be excited to hear about how your team started, origin stories, kind of the background. It's interesting to get kind of the backdrop of what's been going on in Ultimate because it's so player-driven, so culturally interesting the way these things get built and they develop over time, that I would love to have a deeper well of stories to tell on it. So sure. Send us a message and we'll figure out how to get your story on here. Yeah,
sounds like a plan.
I love it. All right, so I have one more little topic for us today as we get down to the end of our time here. I've been watching the basketball.
Yay!
Yeah.
the basketball.
The college basketball, though. Yeah, I know you're not as interested. I've been watching March Madness. You know, I got to give a shout out to my alma mater. Syracuse pulled off a pretty incredible win.
The second most stunning win in the NCAA tournament thus far.
That's the thing. It was only the second
place.
I will tell you, I turned that game on at halftime, though, and I was like, okay, well, this game's over. They were down 15 points.
Supposed to be over.
Virginia was just owning it.
And that's Virginia's game, is defense. Like just getting up ahead owning and it. Grinding the other team to a halt.
Yep. And then Syracuse went on a 25-4 run. And did what Virginia did, just ground them to a halt.
As we say in the business, the wheels fell off.
The wheels not only fell off, they rolled into a ditch, were buried by falling trees.
It's a heck of a game.
We'll never see those again. But yeah, so they made it through as the Orange Men and the Orange Women, both teams, going to the Final Four, which is a pretty cool thing as well.
Well, yeah, there's the NCAA men's tournament, and there's the UConn tournament on the women's side.
Yeah, I've heard. Yeah, I've heard it's renamed.
That's not the way that I've been referring to it, but I've heard it referred to that way multiple times in passing by both sports announcers and commentators and all of that, and just people, because the UConn women are just fantastic to watch.
Shockingly dominant.
Fantastic to watch.
Yeah,
they play great basketball.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to see Syracuse go down there and most likely lose to UNC and
UNC looks to be
and to
team.
See the Syracuse women go down and most likely lose to UConn. But you know, who knows? Crazier things have happened.
Anything can happen.
Anything can happen.
Final Four.
But one of the things I noticed when I was watching is something we were talking about the other day. In the course of the games, you know, you get your close-up video angles, you get all these camera things, and it's loud in those stadiums because it is crowded. So you're not really hearing the players talk or yell, but you're seeing it.
Yeah.
You're seeing the mouth movements. And, you know, I'm not a lip reader. I don't have a ton of experience in this, but I know a curse word when I see it.
Especially some of the more obvious ones.
Especially some of the more obvious ones. And so I noted that during the course of these games, as one would expect from an athletic competition, there were a considerable number of pretty recognizable obscenities being shouted on a somewhat regular basis. At the same time, I didn't see any technicals for that. I want to be clear, I didn't see these curse words being shouted directly in a referee's face. In fact, most of the players are something I was actually really impressed by, because there were some tough calls,
yes,
bad calls even. Most of the players are incredibly respectful of the referees. Whether that's the rules demanding that or just
the
culture,
culture. Yeah.
They will not talk to the referees in college basketball by and large.
Well, it's in college basketball is a little different than the pros, but the whole notion there is it's built out of this concept of, yes, sometimes the calls go against you and there's literally nothing you can do. There are no words that you can say and no actions that you can take to reverse it. None. So whatever you say and whatever you do is just noise for you and your friends or for whoever's watching or for you to make a show. So you know that it's pointless. So like your goal there on some level is to just get rid of it and just accept the bad call.
And go get it back.
Because that's all you can do.
That's all you can do.
The only thing you can do is get to the next whistle, get to the next play, move on, move on, move on.
Yeah, and I'm impressed at how often that is the case. Now the coaches, on the other hand, may get a little more into it. which I've coached before. And
they got to stop letting these guys walk out onto the court while the play is going on. It's ridiculous.
That's ridiculous. That is ridiculous. But anyway, so I was thinking about this, and we talked about this a little bit off and on. The cursing thing. It feels to me, having grown up playing so many sports, that it's just kind of a part of sports.
Yeah.
I would certainly curse when I played soccer, even in high school, though you would get warned about it. I don't remember ever getting carded for it or penalized for it. I remember, well, that's not exactly true. I remember getting penalized for it when I got home, and my mother had a chance to penalize me for it.
It's definitely a different standard. Home standard versus sports standard.
Hi, Mom. I know you watch. Thank you.
Well, so part of that is that it's not the language itself that is the problem. It's what you do with the language that's the problem. If you, you know, losing, like, say you're dribbling on the court, go up for a layup, and somebody blocks your shot, you're naturally really upset about that in the moment. You're like,
yeah, it's not.
Oh, shoot. And it's this sort of thing that you just, it just comes out. It's the same way that if you hit your thumb with a hammer, you say things that you wouldn't say otherwise. Something
terrible things.
Right, something unexpectedly negative happened to you.
Yeah.
And while we can ask everyone to choose their words carefully, and I myself try to do my best job to not curse all the time, it's, you can't always do that. So when we fail at that specific thing, is it more important that we used a word or how we were using that word?
Yeah.
If I turn around to you and start yelling obscenities at you, that's one thing.
That's impolite.
That's not only is it impolite, that's a technical in every sport.
Every sport.
They can find a technical or a yellow card or anything like that. But to just be generally using foul language, either as a quick expression or in a friendly way to your teammates.
Yeah, what about a let's go kind of cursing? Right. Do we like a let's go kind of cursing? Because I got to be honest, I love a let's go cursing.
But then
it's kind of one of my favorite ones.
But you can also have like a foul mouth conversation with your opponent that is in no way disrespectful. You just both happen to have potty mouths at the time.
That is true.
So it goes.
Yep.
But then the other side of that is that if you don't let anybody curse any of the time, what's the value in not cursing? If you let people curse some of the time, then the person who chooses not to curse then has some value because they're choosing not to use something that they are allowed to use. So it's this error, not an error necessarily, it's this choice between what do we want to see and what do we hope people choose to do.
So there are arguments here, of course, right?
Many.
There are some, and the NFL has I've read all of the NFL's rules, which, by the way,
rule book
is,
and very minute,
a terrible experience.
I'm 100% with you. I've gone through that rule book.
It's like reading Moby Dick where someone removed all of the adjectives.
Or it's like reading, it's reading the chapters in Moby Dick that are just about whaling.
Just technical whaling terms. Yeah. It is, it's terrible. So, but I read through it and I got to the point where they talk about the cursing. And basically what they say is players should remember that there are cameras and microphones on the field and should conduct themselves with that in mind. And there's no like penalty, there's no this or that, there's just the admonition to watch your mouth, right? Which I like. And I think that in the age of this intense documentation, this ability to get cameras not only on the field but into the play in a lot of cases, that players should be aware of that. You know, and we should be accommodating of other people's viewpoints. Some people are very offended by cursing. Some people are very offended by certain types of language. And to be inclusive as a sport and to be accommodating as a sport, we should be aware of that and make attempts not to be that way.
We try to create a public space, and sports that you are broadcasting exist in a public space.
Yeah.
So we have general community standards that we want to adhere to. It's a different question in that scenario than it is on the field of play in the heat of battle, so to speak.
Right.
When things happen, tempers flare, passions get excited and all of that. Stuff happens.
And I got to be honest, I think as a sport you want that stuff. Right? Part of what makes sports beautiful is it takes a human who is in everyday life, you're forced to accommodate others so much. You're forced to assimilate into a kind of quiet, more careful environment because we don't want people acting like crazy people murdering each other in the streets, right? But sports are a moment where you take somebody and you drive them to exhaustion, to competitive like levels that they don't see in their day-to-day life. We push ourselves in sports. We push ourselves to limits. We find edges. Yeah. It's all about finding edges. And when you find those edges, your ability to behave in the kind of controlled way that you normally do changes and is broken. And that's a good thing, I think.
And you need to learn how to deal with it. You're not just...
You do.
Naturally, the first time that you're up against that, you're not just going to be the perfect person who doesn't, you know, use any impolite words or anything like that. You're not going to be the perfect teammate the first time you're totally tested. And the first time you think about quitting something, that's when you learn about how you deal with that notion of I've been pushed to the limit. What do I do now? Do I keep going or do I pull back?
It also creates this beautiful ability in sports to separate yourself, right?
Yeah, so it's those are totally fake rules in sports.
Yeah.
This is real life with fake rules.
Real life with fake rules. And there are people who don't curse. Who's the famous Philadelphia Eagle player?
I'm not sure who you're going after right now.
Oh, he's really, really noisy. Did that commercial just recently. It's going to come to me.
I'll tell you, Jalen Rose always makes a
good Jalen Rose is a good
not
one.
Cursing
yes,
after cursing
that's
a
great
a
example.
Previously.
That's actually a better example. Because he turned it off.
And he's someone who constantly was trash talking with and without curse words. So he was always yapping and always talking.
Always talking.
And it was just once he heard himself a couple times, he was like, wait, that's what I sound like? I don't really need to do that, do I?
So he just stopped cursing entirely.
Well, entirely, but you know, it's a sliding scale. It's still you can't. If you drop something. You drop a 2-ton weight on your foot. You're going to say something untoward. Like, why am I in a cartoon?
Most often, you will. It's true. I like this conversation. I think I want to carry this one on. I want to take it up again because I think it's interesting. Not only cursing, but other behavior that is maybe not acceptable in your day-to-day life that actually you get to act out and live out on the playing field.
Yeah.
And the metaphors that go with that, the field of battle, the, you know, all those things.
Yes, metaphors.
Yeah, the metaphors. So we'll get to that next time. But for now, we've run out of time. In fact, we've run over time. I think it's going to be one of our longest episodes yet because I realized I didn't put a timer on before we started. So we've talked right through it. So
one final thing to explain.
Yep.
I have a filthy jersey on. Which is a team that I played on at Kaimana. Lovely tournament in Hawaii. I recommend everybody try to get there, even if you just go and pick up with a team. It's a fantastic time.
Hawaii, beautiful.
And, this is also in honor of the sport I no longer pay attention to, baseball.
Yeah, okay.
Which is starting up here this coming weekend, I believe.
Coming up.
And, you know, got the little Phillies there. It says Filthy on the back. That's the team name. It's one of my favorite jerseys to wear around, usually on Sundays.
Filthy jersey today. Go to Hawaii, apparently, because it's a place to go.
Yes.
And that's all the time we have for today. You can get me at Nick Darling.
At DUSTWEETR.
Or you can get us both at Cleats Cufflinks. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time on Cleats and Cufflinks.